The president delivers his first State of the Union address, and a fight breaks out over a secret memo. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. President Trump stood before Congress to deliver his first State of the Union address, calling for unity. He stressed themes ranging from reviving the economy to an immigration proposal. And while he snagged over 45 million viewers, the nation appears to still be divided. But even as the images faded from the television screen, a spat broke out over a secret memo from the chair of the House Intelligence Committee about FBI conduct in the Russian investigation. To take a look in the State of the Union and also the memo in our studio this morning, Mark McGiver, he's chair of the Wicomico Republican Central Committee. Mike Prettle, he's with the local Democratic Party here. And Michael Laughlin, he's a political science professor at Salisbury University. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So one of the things, by the way, I ran across a poll which said that 62% of those who watched thought that he did an excellent or a good job. However, when you look at the internals, obviously this reflects the kinds of people that watched it. And one of the reasons why apparently there was a bit of a strong support for him is that 43% were Republican and 23% were Democrat. So that kind of tells you a little bit about who was actually watching. Mark, I want to turn to you. And so what did you make of the State of the Union address?
I thought it was a grand slam. He knocked it out of the ballpark. It's interesting, though, you have a statistic, and before I even have a time to say, the CBS poll had showed it like a 75% or so approval. We're already discounting it. I really think that that's not fair. Mm-hmm. You know, let's look at it. CNN even had it at 48. I mean, it was surprised the heck out of me. You can do anything with polls. So I wouldn't put a whole lot of value on that. I mean, I would say that in general, what I saw and what I've heard, not through the media, but people I talk to, is they liked it. They thought it was a good speech, and they were proud that Trump was up there and speaking. And I think they saw a Trump that surprised them. I think they thought that he was this monster that he hears about, you know, in the media day in and day out, and taking his tweets and, you know, putting those up and cutting them down on that. I think they saw a compassionate man who was very dedicated to turning America around and giving it back to the people. And that's what I saw.
What do you think was the strongest element in his speech?
Well, just there were so many. He's done so much just in 1 year. It's hard to just pick one or the other. I mean, the economy, the tax bill, what he's done on regulations. It's all been really, really good and way past overdue in this country. We've been so restricted by government regulations and government laws and this constant turmoil on the Hill in Congress. We can't get anything done. Donald Trump is working. He's getting things done. You may not agree. I mean, he is getting things done, and you got to give the man credit.
Let me ask you the reverse switch is, and I'll be doing this with the Democrats as well here. What do you think was the weakest moment, or what do you think you would have liked to have seen stronger in the speech itself?
I don't know about on Donald Trump. I was very disappointed when they showed the way the Democrats acted during the speech. They were disrespectful to the military. They were they just sat on their hands. Even when Trump announced that the black unemployment was the lowest ever, there was no response from the black caucus. These guys are out of touch. The people that are watching it know better than that. They know that the black unemployment is at a low rate. They know the economy is going to start doing well under Donald Trump. They feel it. But we'll get into that later, I hope. But, yeah, I was disappointed in the Democratic response in the address.
By the way, speaking of that, I think we just got the latest figures. We added, I think, about 200,000 jobs, I think, last month. That's the latest stats to come out, by the way, this morning. I want to talk to Mike Prettle. So what was, first of all, your overall impression? Obviously, you have a different view. But
obviously, I disagree slightly with my friend Mark.
Right.
No, I think the president is a good salesman. As someone said, he's a good huckster, but he is able to sell his line. But I mean, he went into the speech as the least popular president in the history of the country, And certainly least popular in the first year of his presidency. And I don't think he improved his hand nationally. Certainly the Republicans were cheering for him and thought that he – it was one of the two Trump persona. It was the one that was using the teleprompter and stuck pretty well to the teleprompter. Obviously, somebody else wrote the speech for him. It certainly wasn't the kind of speech that he gives ad lib when he's on the hustings, which he is – which he enjoys probably more than he did then. He was somewhat smug and condescending, but you sort of expect that of him. But I think the speech, well, I think there were a number of very bad parts of the thing. He really demonized immigrants over and over again. He made it sound like the biggest threat to the nation currently is the MS-13, which most people never heard of before, and which are causing minor problems in a few cities. But, he brought that up three times, I think, which was a little bit out of it. On the other hand, I think the speech to me was more important for the things he never mentioned or that he passed over. He never mentioned the fact that his own Justice Department and three committees of Congress and the news media and 16 intelligence agencies of his own administration feel that the Russian hacking of our emails and the Russian participation in the election was a major, major problem, and it's on everybody's mind today. And the president seemed not even to be aware of it, or he didn't want to say anything about it. And then we found out that the sanctions law that the Congress passed, I think 97-2 last year, he has refused to enforce, which hasn't received much play. But for some reason, he doesn't feel that sanctions should be imposed.
It does say that he thinks it's having that just the threat is having an effect. Right.
Right. Well, it's easy to say that. But anyway, I mean, he didn't mention, obviously, the investigation that's going on by the special prosecutor, which has never happened before in the first year of any presidency. I was going to say he never mentioned Puerto Rico, but apparently he did. And he mentioned, I think, Texas and California and Puerto Rico, and we'll be there as long as they need us. And then it turns out the next morning, FEMA indicated that they were pulling out of Puerto Rico and they weren't going to give any more aid to Puerto Rico, even though 20 or 30% of people don't have electricity yet. And I think they've walked that back a little bit, but it's inconceivable that when he gave his speech, he didn't know that FEMA was ready to pull the plug on Puerto Rico. He didn't mention the deficit. For some reason, deficits exist, and they're a big, big deal during election campaigns for Republicans. And once they get into office, they don't really talk. Not only don't they talk about them, but they're increasing the deficit by $1.5 trillion, and he's not making an issue of that. He didn't talk about entitlement reform, which Paul Ryan says is the next big thing for the 2018. That's what the Republicans are going to focus on. But I don't think the president even mentioned the fact that they were going to try to cut Social Security and Medicaid this year, which Ryan says they are. He talked about pulling the mandate on the health care bill, but he doesn't say that more than 10 million people are going to lose their health care under it, according to the Congressional Budget Office. He made it sound like that we're more popular than we've ever been with our allies, although recent polling showed that 35 out of 37 nations feel that they had more confidence in Obama than they do in the present president.
Let me ask you one of the questions I asked him, which is, I mean, we know, we understand that there were things you didn't like. What did you think was the strongest portion of the speech? I mean, some folks said that particularly the front end of the speech, people seem to be impressed with.
Well, I think what he tried to convince people, and I think the theme of the speech, at least going in, was that he was now unifying the country, which most of us who have followed politics realize is a farce. But he talked about now we can work on a bipartisan basis. I mean, he talks a good line, but he doesn't follow through in action, or he'll meet with the Democrats and then he'll supposedly make deals with them because he's a great deal maker, and then he disavows the deals as soon as he meets with the Republicans, and they tell him, no, you didn't really mean that. So I think he convinced people that that he's accomplished a lot, that it's going to be a year where where we move forward. But a lot of there's been a lot of fact checking since he made a lot of his comments, and a very little of it.
Mark, I want to ask you because he did talk about unity. He talked about being for and that kind of thing. A lot of folks, when they look back at the past year, find a lot of divisiveness and conflict that's certainly been going on in Washington. How do you assess how he approached the concept of unity? And is there a disconnect, you think, between what we've seen over the past year and his call for unity?
Well,
I mean, go ahead and respond to anything, by the way, that Mike's said here, too.
I don't have time.
I am sympathetic to that.
I was very, very careful not to say anything.
Feel free.
There's a lot that I disagree with what Mike said. But the question here about unity, what has he done to...
I mean, because there are a lot of folks in the nation who view him, at least at this point, as having a fairly divisive tenure, at least the first year. You blame it on whoever you want, as opposed to
the unity factor from a divisive Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's divisive. Everyone saw that at the State of the Union address. The Republicans are standing, and the Democrats are sitting on their hands. But let's talk about decisiveness of the American people. I think that's a whole other issue. I think gradually people in America are seeing the good things that Donald Trump is doing, and he's coming, and they're coming around to that. Just today is Friday in February. I have employees, and I looked at the paychecks today. This is the first day that you see the benefit of Donald Trump's tax, the tax reduction. And son of a gun, there is an increase in my employee's salary, and it's significant. And I'm not giving it to them. It's the government taking less. And that's a lesson that I saw just today. This is the first day. Across the nation, people are going to look at their paycheck and go, wow, I got another $50 this week, or I got another $200 this week. Where did that come from? They won't even know because they're not as informed. But reaching out to the mainstream America, I don't think that Donald Trump is decisive. I think as the more the truth comes out and the media exposes itself for its bias that the American people will see through it and they'll come around to Donald Trump's thing. So I see the divisiveness in Washington, but I don't think I see the divisiveness across the country.
Michael Laughlin, you sit there as a political science professor watching this interesting presidency. How do you assess his address and particularly the concept of unity and where all the elements are here in terms of how we are relating to one another as it gets expressed from the State of the Union?
Well, let me try to place it in the context of what is the normal presidency and what becomes an abnormal presidency. The normal presidency with regard to the State of the Union address is the State of the Union address is one major speech that is an effort to launch the executive budget that will then be presented to the Congress. And so you're launching a policy agenda and then as one step to the nation to try to say, here's my agenda for the country, here's my agenda for the Congress. And then you take off of that to then present the budget and then pursue lobbying of the Congress to pass your budget, to pass the policy initiatives that you got. So in a normal presidency, if this were a normal presidency, Trump presented, whatever you say, a decent speech, a good speech. He did present some initiatives and the like. But what is the situation is actually a very abnormal presidency, more reminiscent of Richard Nixon, in that he is giving this speech in the context of a criminal investigation of his presidency and himself as well by the FBI, by the Justice Department. And that clearly has clouded and continues to cloud certainly his image and his effectiveness going forward. And if past is prologue, I would have to disagree with Mark in the sense that the past year has been a chaotic year that has been... Clearly, this president has been engaged in various attacks, on ad hominem attacks, ridicule of his political opponents, even his political allies. He ridicules and has been attacking his own Justice Department, the Republican Justice Department, Republican FBI. And so you have this backdrop of a chaotic presidency going forward. I mean, it's true he got a big tax package through, and perhaps that might help save his if not himself, save the Republican Party going forward if it has the consequences that Mark is pointing out. But this is an abnormal situation, and there's no indication. Well, we'll see in terms of whether it very seldom is it the case that one speech will turn around a public opinion broadly. And clearly the public opinion right now is in the cellar for this president. Whether this speech and follow-up action will, in fact, bring him up is another question. Very difficult, though. It's most of the time that does not happen.
I would note, by the way, that actually Nixon, I think it was 1974 in his State of the Union, he, at the very end, then said, enough, a year enough of Watergate is enough. On the other hand, Bill Clinton, of course, never mentioned the Lewinsky scandal at all in his State of the Union. So let's just get
it
that one.
I think it was wise for Trump not to, because the court of what race, what the parallel would include.
Go ahead. I make a comment about what you said.
Go ahead.
And I do agree with you that this is not a normal presidency. But I would submit to you that that is the key to his success, and that will be the key to his presidency and his reelection in 3 years from now. Normal presidencies have not been effective lately, but in order for Donald Trump to go to Washington and get through the things that he promised that he would get through, he knew it was going to be a battle. And that's exactly what it's turned out to be. There's no question that the media has been out to get him, has been out to undo whatever he says, ever since he was elected, even before he was elected. So, you know, he knew that they were no friend. And we were talking about Twitter right before the thing. That he says, I don't need the media, and I'll go around the media, directly to the American people. And that's not normal. But that's been the key to his success. And just because the people in Washington are having a problem and you want to call it chaotic, I call it very successful, because the bureaucrats in D.C. needed to be shaken up. Right now, we have the largest revenue income that this country has ever had. There has been no shortage of tax revenue going into the government. But we still have a deficit. Why is that? Because the spending has gone up higher than the revenues. This has got to stop. And if you're going to go to Washington and you're going to tell this big bureaucracy they got to cut back 10%, 20% of their budget, you have a battle on your hand. And that's exactly what Donald Trump has. He has a battle on his hand, and he's doing how he knows best to deal with it. And you're absolutely right. It is not normal.
Mike Cradle, you?
Well, Mark feels that as the demonizing the media efforts they've been doing from the beginning. The media, unfortunately, has to correct the statements that Trump throws out all the time on his Twitter. So, I mean, there's been fact-checking, and I think they've found that he's averaging about 6 lies or misstatements a day during his first year, which is certainly unusual, you know. And that's all documented. I mean, he can quibble with some of the things, but, he talks about the unemployment rate being lower, which it is, but it's on the same line that and Obama reduced the unemployment rate more during his last few years than Trump did during this year. And the same is true of the stock market. It's on the same trajectory that Obama started him on. And Mark talks about some of his employees are going to find a few more bucks in their paycheck every month. But as we speak, the Maryland General Assembly is meeting and passing some corrective legislation to try to take care of some of the problems that are being created for Maryland taxpayers and for Maryland revenues caused by the actions that the Trump administration is taking in Washington. They've already set up a commission to deal with the changes in the medical system that will be created by the relatively small but yet significant change in the Obamacare formula. And my taxes are going to be higher next year because they've disallowed tax deductions. We heard just 2 weeks ago from someone from Maryland Nonprofits who does research on this. He said that Maryland nonprofit organizations are going to lose between $200 and $400 million a year, estimated, as a result of the new tax bill. And that's a lot of money for the nonprofit organizations in a small state like Maryland. $200, $400 million that are going to have to be made up by somebody. And, it ain't going to be the federal government. So Anyway, so, I mean, there's a lot of holes in the arguments that Trump is making and that Mark is making for him today.
Well, let me turn to Mark, because one of the things that there is this kind of result of the tax cut resulting in a number of states having to figure out how to make adjustments so that their own taxpayers are not paying more in state tax. We obviously see this in the state of Maryland. Was that just simply an unintended consequence? Were people thinking it through, do you think, in terms of a tax cut like that?
I mean, if you look at the whole picture, you understand that the previous system was really not fair if you look at it across the entire country, because states that have a high tax rate, California, Maryland, New York, then they are taxing the citizens of that state very at an above average rate. They're paying a lot of taxes. So what happens is they get the deduction for the state revenue income, but then as a result, they pay less into the federal government coffers. That's not fair. That's not fair to the other states that run a very responsible state government. And as a result, have low taxes. They have a good industrial base because they're not regulating them out of a job. So I think that it's very fair. And to respond to Mike's comments, the state of Maryland in Annapolis, instead of trying to figure out how to balance this out, the solution, Mike, is very simple. Annapolis has to figure out how to cut their taxes. We are in a high tax state
because we have the best schools in the country, and we're going
to. I didn't interrupt you. I had to sit on my hands. I sat on my hands and let you speak.
Go ahead. Go, Mark.
Maryland has to cut their expenditures, and they have to make the tough decisions. Other states have done it. And another comment about the Maryland health bill that they have to fix because of what Trump did to Obamacare. I'm going to tell you something. Maryland had a great health care system before Obamacare. Obamacare has killed a lot of great state medical systems across the country. And that's what the problem is. I can tell you my health bill for what I pay for my wife and I went from $700 a month to $1,100 a month, and this year we're up to $1,500 a month for two people to have health care. This is out of control, and there's no way a lot of people can even afford this. You want to talk about people losing their health care, the prices to join health care and have a decent health care system are through the roof, and there's no indication that I've seen that this is going to end. Well, the mandate, I'm not sure, but what we need to implement to the one thing we need to implement to improve this system, fix it, is to have a cross-state, open health care systems that we can pick from. Well, we're down to one or two providers here in Maryland, and there's no way you're going to get a good deal with one or two. I always thought of this. Look, if you want to drive, you have to have auto insurance. And you can buy auto insurance from Geico. You can't watch the TV for more than 4 minutes without seeing two or three insurance commercials. It works great, and they have across state line policies, but they won't allow that with Obamacare disallowed that, and that's one thing Trump wants to put on. And I can't wait to see it, because as soon as that is implemented, I'm going to be shopping. I'm going to tell you that right now.
Mark, I don't know whether you know the history, but for years, the Republicans were the ones that believed each state should have their own system. They believed in states' rights, and therefore each state has their own insurance commission. But now that there's a bill passed that's national in scope, they say, oh, no, we ought to have national insurance. Maybe we should. We should probably have single-payer insurance that covers everybody, and I would agree with that. But I mean, Mark says, fine, he's got health insurance. I have health insurance. I'm sure that everybody in this room does, but there were 15% of people in Maryland didn't have any health insurance, couldn't afford any health insurance before Obamacare. And now I think it's down to about 7%. So we've cut in half the number of people that that are uninsured in the state of Maryland.
I'm not sure about your numbers, but the state of Maryland had a fund. It was a state fund. It was just like the way the auto insurance worked.
That we paid for.
It worked great.
You pay it one way or the other. Yeah, we were paying for the uninsured, you know, and this barely.
We were doing it, but we left it up to our state to do it, not the federal government. You keep this stuff localized at a state level, and you're going to have a lot less problems.
Okay, I want to turn from health care, which we, I'm sure could go on for another half hour here. Michael Laughlin, the thing that really struck me is, my predecessor sort of mentioned a bit, is the issue of immigration. We certainly heard some pretty harsh images about MS-13 and immigration, almost equating at one point, as I was watching it, with some dreamers or people who had come here as minors and committed these crimes as a result of them being part of MS-13. On the other hand, he offered up a list of ideas that he was willing to consider, which, you know, the Dreamers, for instance, DACA, he was willing to take a look at maybe paths to the citizenship. He obviously wants more security in terms of the wall. What the wall means, we're not really sure. He does want to get rid of the visa lottery. The diversity in these areas. And then he wants to, in some fashion, change what's been called chain immigration or its family unity, depending on which side of the argument you are at. So he did offer up a package. As a matter of fact, I was talking to one Republican earlier this week who suggested that it could be Donald Trump who actually provides, in their words, amnesty to the Dreamers, as it were. In other words, he could actually be giving somebody something the Democrats have certainly wanted for a long time. The Hispanic community has wanted for a long time, particularly in terms of Dreamers and some kind of immigration change. How do you see that playing out in terms of what the relationship has been with, say, the Republican Party and the Hispanic community, and particularly the immigrant community? And is it possible that he could get something through like that and benefit from it?
Yes, I think it actually is possible, and the evidence for that is the deal that Schumer and Trump had cut at the White House, where Schumer, the minority leader, Senate minority leader, Democratic minority leader, was able to say, all right, Mr. President, here's some money for the wall. I mean, symbolically or however you want to describe the wall, there was okay, we're negotiating. I'll give you this if you give us DACA, if you go along with that. That appeared to be the deal that was cut, and then of course it was withdrawn once Republican conservatives got to him and said, well, no, we can't cut that deal. But what I think what that indicates is that there is part of Trump that if he can get his manifest campaign promises fulfilled, like something called the wall, he'd be willing to cut some of these deals on immigration. How far he would go is unclear. More importantly, how far the Republican Congress is willing to go, I think, is a real catch, because they have to go up for re-election come the fall. And once again, the present politics says you've got to play to your base. Trump still is going to lean in that direction. I mean, what fails the deal, or where the Schumer deal fell through, of course, was the conservatives reminded Trump that the base will not go for that, and we have to withdraw from that. The conservatives in the Congress, particularly in the House of Representatives, that may be the real stumbling block to prevent any significant immigration change.
One of the other things, too, one of the suggestions that's been out there, and I don't know whether it was necessarily a State of the Union proposal, was the idea of cutting legal immigration in addition to whatever changes they want. Michael Laughlin, what do you make of that? Because people have suggested this harkens back to the 1924 immigration law, which basically focused on having immigrants from northern and Western Europe as opposed to Southern Europe and obviously the East. What do you make? I mean, is there a shift going on in terms? I mean, I've never heard in all the immigration stuff I've followed over the years, we've always talked about undocumented immigration, and there hasn't been, and even with the discussions about what we should have people with skills and so on, which I think is important, we've never had a discussion or a suggestion that we should necessarily cut the numbers.
My sense about that, and I haven't seen any empirical numbers in terms of what opinion of the base that is being appealed to. But clearly, I think what I would suggest is this reveals one of, I mean, Donald Trump is a bigot. He is a bigot. He's a nativist. And so immigration for him, illegal immigration is the worst part. But even immigration, I mean, clearly he's made racist comments all through the campaign this past year against Mexicans, against Latinos, against Muslims, against other folks. And so I think that comes fairly natural to him. And clearly there's part of the base that is appealing of that too, a nativist base. How strong that is unclear yet to me.
Mark, so what do you make of his proposal? Could he benefit from it? I mean, I remember in 1986, Ronald Reagan passed this immigration reform bill, legalized lots of folks who were here illegally, and the Republicans didn't benefit. I mean, is there what? How do you
because
see that relationship?
But yeah, broken. Reagan made this deal to give amnesty to illegal immigrants in exchange for a border security. So he gave him amnesty, but there was no border security. The border security, the wall, is the heart of the whole issue here. Without border security, if we cannot control who comes into this country, there's no sense even talking about amnesty. Because it would do, if we propose an amnesty program before securing the wall, it would only encourage more illegals to come into the country. I mean, that's just common sense. I would do that. I mean, that's just common sense. So as far as illegal immigration, that would be my response. But as far as legal immigration, now that's a different issue. And a lot of people confuse that. The problem with legal immigration, as Trump pointed out at the State of the Union address, is that the type of immigrants that are coming into our country are not people that actually economically benefit our country. And I think that that's kind of our right, that we can pick and choose who wants to come in. And right now, a percentage of people that are granted legal residency or legal entry into this country is, and you have to state, you know, why you want to come. And 72% are for family basis, mm-hmm. like you are, it's your uncle or your aunt or whatever. And only, where is it? It's 12% of green cards are employment-based. In other words, we bring in only 12% of the legal immigrants are coming in because they have a job or they're going to work. They're going to be part of the workforce. So that's a huge problem, and that's what Donald Trump was pointing out there. We need to change that around. I'm not sure about reducing numbers, but we need to get the right balance. Now, for Canada, for instance, Canada has 26% of the entries into Canada are family-related, and the 52% are economic-based. So they know that when they bring in people, if they're not going to be productive, it's going to cost them money. It's going to be a drain on their GNP. Canada understands that. And there's similar statistics here for Australia. So they know what they're doing. But here, when we bring in 72% of people who are not going to participate in our economy, they're going to be a drain. And I can tell you one other thing. I'm married to my wife. She's Egyptian. She came into this country under the green card. And then, you know, I met her after that point. But then she became a U.S. citizen after that. I always tease her. She had to do it the hard way. She had to stay married to me for 5 years.
tough.
Yeah, that was, that was punishment beyond belief. But that was 34 years ago I married to my wife.
Congrats.
So, yeah, she's a great woman. So I have to throw. So, but when we wanted to get a visa for her father to come, it was a process. It wasn't, you know, just come over here. Here's a plane ticket. We had to ensure that he'd be here. We had to sign for him, basically, that, you know, I guess we'd bail him out of jail or something if he got in trouble. I'm just teasing. But, you know, the main thing was we had to basically set a bond or ensure that he had insurance, health insurance. so that he wouldn't be a burden to the American healthcare system. This is part of the requirements that we impose on legal immigrants when we come over. And all that is lost with the illegal immigrants that come over. It's a great drain on our economy.
So I'm going to Mike Prettle here, our Democrat.
Yeah,
but one of the things before we, because I want to sort of reemphasize this, because this is something I've noticed. There are other countries do emphasize particularly skills based as opposed to chain or what might be called family unification, which right you have families that then create stability and so on. So there are is there a legitimate debate or discussion we should be having about the shape of immigration as what do you think?
There is and there should be, and unfortunately we can't have it because as Michael O'Loughlin pointed out that the president has polarized pretty much and has demonized immigration in general. You know, I mean, number one, to respond to some of Mark's comments, the head of the Border Security Commission, whatever it's called, the federal agency that handles that, has recently retired. You may not be aware of that. Within the last week. And on his way out the door, he said, the wall is a big mistake. It will never work. It's foolish for us to spend that kind of money because it's not going to accomplish what, you know, I mean, he's the man who's the expert, who's Trump's expert in border security. And he says, this is stupid. It doesn't make any sense. Number two, you know, Mark points out his father-in-law came in. Well, his father-in-law wouldn't be able to come in under the Trump plan that's being proposed. I mean, that's what Trump is calling chain immigration. It's a term that he made up or that's been made up by the Republicans just in the last year or so. But, I mean, they're the kind of people who we probably should have. And I agree with the process that there should be some security posted and some vetting, certainly, of these people coming in. But why not let your father-in-law come in? Should he be excluded? You know, that would be done under the present Trump plan, as I understand it. They're only restricting it, I think, to children and siblings, but not to parents. And that's become a big uproar because there are many people like Mark's wife who come in here. I met Mark's wife. She's a wonderful lady who are very successful in doing what they're doing here. And they would like to bring their elderly parents in from the old country to share in the benefits in their waning years. And under the Trump plan, that is no longer possible. I saw numbers the other day that under the plan that Trump has proposed, I think approximately 45%, we have a reduction of about 45% in the number of legal immigrants that will come in the coming year as compared to all the way back to the Reagan years. So, you know, so it would cause a substantial reduction. And apparently that's playing to his base. Although as Michael O'Loughlin pointed out, the strongest opposition to the new Trump plan is coming not from the Democrats, but from the Freedom Party and the right-wing Republicans who want to throw immigration off the table completely. They don't want any plan. So they're opposed to the Trump plan, and there is a serious question whether it would get through the House today. With respect to plans that Trump already has in place, I saw some numbers just this morning that there have been the seven countries that are barred under the plan that has been now approved by one of the courts. There's not been a single terrorist incident caused by anybody who has come in from any of those seven countries. Also, the chances of being killed by a Muslim extremist in the United States is about 1/6 of the risk of being a Muslim killed by an extremist, an anti-Muslim extremist. So they're getting the burdens of it, even though they're not participating in this.
Let me a couple of things because I want to turn to the Democratic response. But although one thing I should note is that studies have indicated that even the undocumented immigrants are contributing economically. They may not be contributing as much as, for instance, so some people would like, and
a tremendous number of entrepreneurs
so
are people
sure.
who came in, you know, either legally or illegally, but they came in for education, which is not having a job, Mark, as you say. People don't come in. A huge number of immigrants come in for education and stay here, some of them illegally. But there are 50,000 Irish illegal immigrants in this country, which nobody talks about, except for the Irish people who are concerned about it.
Okay. Anyway, so I want to Joe Kennedy, Representative Joe Kennedy. And I must say, from my own personal reaction, I, at least in presentation wise, I can't say I was particularly impressed. But the interesting sort of thing that comes out of it the day after is people fixed on the idea of bullies. He talked about bullies may land a punch, but they never manage to match the strength of the American people. Made no direct reference to the president, but it's certainly by implication. What did you make of the Democratic response, or is it just going to disappear, never to be seen? And who was it for? Some people suggested it was for progressives as opposed to necessarily for the broad. I mean, what did you make?
I wasn't that impressed, and I don't think anybody's paying a whole lot of attention to it. You know, I mean, I watched the whole thing, but I don't think I had any major talking points. And, you know, I think it was frankly, it was a boost to Mr. Kennedy, who was trying to be this generation's Kennedy, and I'm not sure whether he's qualified or not. He certainly is. To use the old phrase, he's not John Kennedy. You know?
Right.
Right. No, I don't think it was that impressive. But
Am I allowed to agree with you?
Yes, you're allowed to do that. Every once in a while, we get that right.
People agree that the governor of Louisiana was terrible.
Well,
that's
true
around,
too.
You know?
Right.
I looked at
Governor General. Yeah. I mean,
the Kennedy response. I just looked. There was no substance.
Right.
That's the typical of any of the Democratic responses. It's criticism, you know, they're hitting on Donald Trump, but there is no new proposals that they're putting on themselves. So,
that's not true. I mean,
not in the speech.
If I may go into this, I mean, Trump mentioned we should have job training. You know, the Democrats have been pushing for job training for year after year after year after year, and it's been blocked by the Republicans. And now Donald Trump says, hey, one of the solutions to our unemployment problem is job training. And, you know, welcome aboard. I think that's one of the things that the Democrats clapped for and the Republicans didn't clap for because they've been opposed to it. They blocked every job training bill that the Dems have been trying to put forward for years.
Go ahead.
I'm not sure of that. You cite a lot of statistics and things, but I'd have to check the sources. I'm not sure that job training really falls under the federal government. I think it'd be a lot more effective at a state level.
Trump asked for it. He proposed it.
I think we've spent our money a lot worse ways than job training. That's for sure.
So I have to also finally, we need to talk about the memo.
Did it come out yet?
It has not come out yet. I think they expect it today, maybe.
Yeah.
And actually, I heard that the Democratic response might actually be released sometime next week. But that's what I heard. So it's just an update. So this is a memo that was produced by a House Intelligence Committee staff under Chairman Devin Nunes. And essentially is what we hear anyway, because nobody's seen it yet. Well, in the public, that it's fairly critical of the FBI investigation into the Russian affair, particularly how they got the FISA warrant, that's an intelligence warrant, to track Carter Page. Although I understand that actually Carter Page showed up on the FBI radar in 2013.
Right.
So that's sort of interesting. The Democratic response, obviously, is that they've cherry-picked the facts and so on and so forth. Mike Prettl, so what do you make of this, first of all, in terms of particularly how it relates to the ongoing investigation and Robert Mueller and Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General? What do you make of this? Somebody suggested last night that we're going to be fixated with this thing for about a couple of days, and in a month from now, it'll just disappear forever. I mean,
obvious attempt to get ahead of the revelations that are going to come out of Robert Mueller's investigation, and to try to smear the FBI, which is ironic. I mean, I've been fooling around with politics for 40-some years or so, and, you know, the FBI has always been this Republican J. Edgar Hoover, you know, monstrosity to some extent, which did some really bad things back in the 50s and 60s. But they're trying to smear Mueller. They're trying to smear the FBI. They're apparently going to smear Rod Rosenstein, who has come out of this thing as being the one objective, fair-minded person in the thing, but apparently they say some nasty things about him. And Don, I don't know whether I disagree with you or not, but my understanding is that the committee has refused to permit the Democratic response to it to be made public. Now, whether
There's been some. I heard there was possibly some negotiation going on, but we'll see.
Unless they're actually opposed to it because you know they want it one sided. Matter of fact, apparently Nunes altered the thing, amended it after it was released, after it was reviewed by members of Congress. He's changed it further, and he's insisting on his version come out. Nunes disqualified himself last year after it was shown that he was basically flacking for the president. He's the one who pulled that crazy stunt of going to the White House at 1 o'clock in the morning and making believe he was there to pick up some papers, but actually he was delivering some, you know, it was a joke. And Nunes, after that, was discredited. It was told that he was no longer going to be chairing the committee, and he said, okay, fine, he'd back out. And he's retiring from Congress, but now he apparently is getting his last crack in by putting out this piece of paper, which he prepared and which he amended to smear the FBI, basically. And I think it's outrageous, and I think it does tremendous harm to our rule of law in this country for the FBI to be criticized because they dare to say some things that are objective, that are fair about the connections that certain members, at least of the president's staff, have had with the Russians.
Mark, what do you make of this memo? And is it significant? How do you see it relating? My partner here has obviously characterized it as a certain way. He thinks it's being drawn up for a particular purpose. What do you make of this?
I think it's a very grave that this could have some very serious side effects. I think you have to start basically the history of FISA, and that was started after 9/11. And that was given the federal government, the Justice Department, and the FBI the ability to eavesdrop on foreign agents. And there was a real danger there because you're given FBI authority to wiretap, basically. So they put restrictions on it, and they said, look, you can't use this to go after American citizens. And in order to get these warrants, you need to go to a judge as an oversight. Everything in this country has an oversight, and that includes the FBI. So they go to it. Now the issue here is, did they use unverified information and mislead a federal judge in order to get a warrant? And then furthermore, after they got the warrant, did they use the information to spy on Americans? And more than that, were these Americans an opposing political party? This is extremely serious. This goes to the heart of our Constitution. This is like Watergate is this hill in front of the Elks Club in Salisbury, and the other is Mount Everest. This is Mount Everest. This is if one party conspired to undo a political opponent using their police powers, this is grave. This is a attempted coup. Now, I'm not saying they did that, but if we got to watch this memo, let's see what the memo says. Did the FBI go to the FISA court and mislead them, and did they use that information to go after political opponents of Hillary Clinton? And did they? What did they use for the basis of that FISA warrant? And the real argument, the real interest here is, did they use the DNC, the Democrat National Party's funded and Hillary Clinton's funded dossier to do this? And this is a dossier that they paid the agent for and didn't verify anything on it. It's completely false. You have Mueller investigating this thing for a year, right? What do we have on Russian collusion with Trump? Zero. We have zero.
We have his campaign manager indicted. So federal indictment. That's it.
The FISA, this memo today, it could be earth shattering. But again, you get all this hype. Mike, you might be right. It might be done in
Mark,
4 days.
You're apparently unaware of some of the facts. The facts are that this was not going to the FISA court to get a warrant to investigate. It was to renew a warrant that had been in place, as Don said, going back several years before there was even a campaign between Trump and Clinton. You know, so all it was,
it
was renewal.
Secondly, it was issued in
What I know of it is, it was issued in I think the summer. I think it is, or maybe a little later.
But the dossier was only used.
And it was actually applied for before that, and it was turned down by the fire.
The dossier was used for the renewal of the warrant that had already been outstanding. Secondly, the dossier was paid for originally by Republican opponents of Trump. Okay. And when Trump got the nomination, then the Democratic National Committee, or a lawyer,
the DNC and the Hillary campaign, and I understand
they
the FBI
took it over,
and they paid for this.
Okay, they paid for a dossier that had already been put together before the Republicans.
But it's unverified, and then it was used by the FBI to secure the warrants. The court had the
background on it. The court knew that this was just one of several. But they already had, as Don pointed out, they had information
and
on
I
this guy
tell you
going back
else.
To 2013.
The FBI being upset about this being released is absurd, because by law the FBI answers to the congressional committee. That committee is the oversight committee for the FBI. The FBI works for the federal government, for the people of this country, and they have to answer to this congressional hearing.
And they gave the information to the committee, but the FBI is part of the Justice
Department.
You know
what, Mike? It took 1 year to get that information. And it didn't come until the last minute when the committee wanted to have them held under the contempt of Congress to get that information. And then when they submit it at the last minute,
Mark.
What kind of FBI, by their actions, are showing that they are out of control.
Mark, the FBI is part of the Justice Department, which is run by Mr. Sessions and Mr. Rosenstein. That's who they report to. Now
they do, but under the oversight of the congressional committee.
And the information is available to the committee, but it's a question of whether it should be disclosed to the public. And Rod Rosenstein, who is the charge of that for the Justice Department, as well as the head of the FBI, which was recently appointed by Trump, and he said all sorts of nice things about the new head of the FBI. Both of them had said that some of the data in there is classified, and to disclose it would do damage to the security system in this country.
That's what the FBI said. They also said it would be embarrassing, and it would undermine what the FBI's image and all of this. So that shouldn't even be a factor. I agree, if this memo has classified information, it shouldn't be released, because it would inhibit our ability to do their job. That's why it goes to the President of the United States. He has the authority, he has 5 days to determine whether this is classified information, and it is up to the President of the United States to declassify it. If he declassifies it, then it's okay to release.
Well, let me ask
you. That's the way our system
works.
You may not like it. That's the way it works.
Should he not listen to the Republican Justice Department? Should he not listen to the Republican Justice? Should not he not listen to his own Attorney General and Assistant Attorney General?
The Justice Department, FBI, I don't believe that they are Democrat or they are Republican. They are
Mr.
a police
Sessions?
Force. They are a police force that work to ensure the safety of the United States citizens.
Well, let me ask you this. There's a pause here. So the president this morning, just to update everybody, tweeted, as he does, he praised the rank and file of the FBI, but he clearly said that he thought that there had been some kind of politicization of the leadership. I'm assuming leadership from before the election, and I'm assuming then maybe afterwards, because obviously, as we're talking about Rod Rosenstein. And the other thing, apparently, as I've read some reports, that the president has also told people that he thinks that the memo is going to undermine Robert Mueller's investigation of the Russian affair and so on. That's what we have up to date. I'm kind of curious about, if we step back from just the memo, what certainly appears to be attacks on the part of the president, just publicly, even if you put aside some of the reporting, on the FBI, that it's in tatters, that its leadership is political, and so on and so forth. I mean, what does that say about the relationship between this president or the presidency and law enforcement? I mean, it's I mean, I'm not sure what to make of it. I mean, Mike or
this president's the one who's been saying, "Oh, we support law enforcement, rah rah rah."
But
his own law enforcement, which is the FBI, he doesn't support, and he criticizes it. He says they're in tatters, and he appointed a new head of the FBI, and now he's going against the new head of the FBI because he thinks he's politicized. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Has this all become personal? I mean, I can remember. Looking like the Nixon and certainly the Iran thing, right? But there was never this kind of line. I mean, it just seems very personal that the president has taken this. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's the way. It's the impression. I'm just looking at the tweets. You know, forget about.
I think Trump has made it very clear that he supports the men and women in the main ranks of the FBI. He's made it very clear that he has some questions about the actions of the leadership of the FBI that were appointed during the Obama administration. And I don't think the FBI has done anything to ease those concerns. Just lately, they asked for the emails between two suspended or removed FBI agents from the Mueller investigation. The FBI comes back and says, here are the emails, but we lost 5 months of emails, and we can't recover them. Let me tell you something. As an average American listening to that, I'm like, this is outrageous. The FBI is the foremost authority in the
Mark,
world.
Mark, they found them, and there's nothing there.
No. FBI didn't found them. It was the Department of Justice had to go into the FBI and say, oh, here they are. And then within 48 hours, they recovered them after the FBI said that they were lost.
There's nothing there.
There is nothing there because the FBI, it's outrageous that they didn't comply and that they tried to tell the United States Congress that they lost these emails. This does nothing to their credibility. What's going on? Let's get to the bottom of it. Let's release the memo. It's been cleared. It's no longer.
Should they release the Democratic response to it?
The Democratic response came up a week or two later. There's a process this committee goes through to release memos and documents, and that document will probably be released.
They said they won't. The Republicans
are opposed to it.
Let's see if they go ahead and release it. By the way, on the FBI, on these emails, two things. One is that they were looking at, apparently it was some changeover in the phones and all the rest of that stuff that they couldn't track. They brought some forensic people in, and this thing affected not just the two people, but like all these FBI agents. I mean, it was just like this sort of thing that happened. So I'm not sure I ascribe the little as sinister, I guess, is. But I got to leave it there because I got to get out of here. My engineer is telling me Mike Guyver, he is the chair of the Wicomico Republican Central Committee. Mike Prettle, he's with the local Democratic Party. We've also had Michael Laughlin. He is a political science professor at Salisbury University. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.